But that's plain to see. My poor dear Felice. That's it. Drink up. As her guest was working on the flagon, Cersei went to the door and called her maids. She told Dorcas to find Lord Qyburn for her and bring him here at once. Jocelyn Swift she dispatched to the kitchens. Bring bread and cheese, a meat pie, and some apples, and wine. We have a thirst. Qyburn arrived before the food. Lady Felice had put down three more cups by then, and was beginning to nod, though from time to time she would rouse and give another sob. The Queen took Qyburn aside, and told him of Sir Balmain's folly. I cannot have Felice spreading tales about the city. Her grief has made her witless. Do you still need women for your, work?
I do, Your Grace. The puppeteers are quite used up.
Take her, and do with her what you will, then. But once she goes down into the black cells, need I say more?
No, Your Grace, I understand.
Good. The Queen donned her smile once again. Sweet Felice, Maester Qyburn's here. He'll help you to rest.
Oh, said Felice vaguely. Oh, good.
When the door closed behind them, Cersei poured herself another cup of wine. I am surrounded by enemies and imbeciles, she said. She could not even trust to her own blood and kin, nor Jamie, who had once been her other half. He was meant to be my sword and shield, my strong right arm. Why does he insist on vexing me? Bronn was no more than an annoyance, to be sure. She had never truly believed that he was harbouring the imp. Her twisted little brother was too clever to allow Lullis to name her wretched, ill-begotten bastard after him, knowing it was sure to draw the Queen's wrath down upon her. Lady Merryweather had pointed that out, and she was right. The mockery was almost certainly the sellsword's doing. She could picture him watching his wrinkled red stepson sucking on one of Lolly's swollen dugs, a cup of wine in his hand, and an insolent smile on his face. Grin all you wish, Sir Bronn. You'll be screaming soon enough. Enjoy your lackwit lady and your stolen castle whilst you can. When the time comes, I shall swat you as if you were a fly. Perhaps she would send Loras Tyrell to do the swatting, if the Knight of Flowers should somehow return alive from Dragonstone. That would be delicious. If the gods were good, each of them would kill the other, like Sir Arrak and Sir Eric. As for Stokeworth, no, she was sick of thinking about Stokeworth. Taina had drifted back to sleep by the time the Queen returned to the bedchamber, her head spinning. Too much wine and too little sleep, she told herself. It was not every night that she was awakened twice with such desperate tidings. At least I could awaken. Robert would have been too drunk to rise, let alone rule. It would have fallen to John Arryn to deal with all of this. It pleased her to think that she made a better king than Robert. The sky outside the window was already beginning to lighten. Cersei sat on the bed beside Lady Merryweather, listening to her soft breathing, watching her breath rise and fall. Does she dream of Mere? She wondered. Or is it her lover with the scar, the dangerous dark-haired man, who would not be refused? She was quite certain Taina was not dreaming of Lord Orton. Cersei cupped the other woman's breast. Softly at first, hardly touching, feeling the warmth of it beneath her palm, the skin as smooth as satin. She gave it a gentle squeeze, then ran her thumbnail lightly across the big dark nipple, back and forth and back and forth, until she felt it stiffen. When she glanced up, Taina's eyes were open. "Does that feel good?" she asked. "Yes," said Lady Merryweather. And this? Cersei pinched the nipple now, pulling on it hard, twisting it between her fingers. The Meerish woman gave a gasp of pain. Oh, you're hurting me. It's just the wine. I had a flagon with my supper, and another with the widow Stokeworth. I had to drink to keep her calm. She twisted Taina's other nipple, too, pulling until the other woman gasped. I am the queen.
I mean to claim my rights. Do what you will. Taina's hair was as black as Robert's, even down between her legs, and when Cersei touched her there, she found her hair all sopping wet, where Robert's had been coarse and dry. Please, the Meerish woman said, go on, my queen. Do as you will with me. I'm yours. But it was no good. She could not feel it, whatever Robert felt on the nights he took her. There was no pleasure in it. Not for her. For Taina, yes, her nipples were two black diamonds, her sex slick and steamy. Robert would have loved you for an hour. The queen slid a finger into that Meerish swamp, then another, moving them in and out. But once he had spent himself inside you, he would have been hard-pressed to recall your name. She wanted to see if it would be as easy with a woman as it had always been with Robert. 10,000 of your children perished in my palm, Your Grace, she thought, slipping a third finger into Mir. Whilst you snored, I would lick your sons off my face and fingers one by one, all those pale, sticky princes. You claim your rights, my lord, but in the darkness I would eat your heirs. Taina gave a shudder. She gasped some words in a foreign tongue, then shuddered again and arched her back and screamed. She sounds as if she's being gored, the queen thought. For a moment she let herself imagine that her fingers were a boar's tusks, ripping the Meerish woman apart from groin to throat. It was still no good. It had never been any good with anyone but Jamie. When she tried to take her hand away, Taina caught it and kissed her fingers. Her sweet queen, how shall I pleasure you? She slid her hand down Cersei's side and touched her sex. Tell me what you would have of me, my love. Leave me. Cersei rolled away and pulled out the bedclothes to cover herself, shivering. Dawn was breaking. It would be morning soon, and all of this would be forgotten. It had never happened. Jamie. The trumpets made a brazen blare and cut the still blue air of dusk. Jasmine Peckledon was on his feet at once, scrambling for his master's sword belt. Ah, the boy has good instincts. Outlaws don't blow trumpets to herald their arrival, Jamie told him. I shan't need my sword. That will be my cousin, the Warden of the West. The riders were dismounting when he emerged from his tent, half a dozen knights, and 20 mounted archers and men-at-arms. Jamie! Roared a shaggy man, clad in gilded ringmail and a fox fur cloak. So gaunt, and all in white. And bearded, too. This? Mere stubble against that mane of yours, coz. Sir Davin's bristling beard and bushy moustache grew into side whiskers as thick as a hedgerow, and those into the tangled yellow thicket atop his head, matted down by the helm he was removing. Somewhere in the midst of all that hair lurked a pug nose and a pair of lively hazel eyes. Did some outlaw steal your razor? I vowed I would not let my hair be cut until my father was avenged. For a man who looked so leonine, but Evan Lannister sounded oddly sheepish. The young wolf got to Carstock first, though. Robbed me of my vengeance. He handed his helm to a squire and pushed his fingers through his hair where the weight of the steel had crushed it down. I like a bit of air. The nights grow colder, and a little foliage helps to keep your face warm. I and Aunt Jenna always said I had a brick for a chin. He clasped Jamie by the arms. We're feared for you, after the Whispering Wood. Heard Stark's dire wolf tore out your throat. Did you weep bitter tears for me, cos? Half of Lannisport was mourning. The female half. Sir Devon's gaze went to Jamie's stump. So it's true. The bastards took your sword and. I have a new one, made of gold. There's much to be said for being one-handed. I drink less wine for fear of spilling, and I'm seldom inclined to scratch my arse at court. Aye, there's that, maybe. I should have mine off as well. His cousin laughed. Was it Caitlin Stark who took it?
Varga Holt.
Where do these tales come from? The Kohorik, Sir Davin spat. That's for him, and all his brave companions. I told your father I would forage for him, but he refused me. Some tusks are fit for lions, he said, but foraging is best left for goats and dogs. Lord Tywin's very words, Jamie knew. He could almost hear his father's voice. Come inside, Cos. We need to talk. Garrett had lit the braziers, and their glowing coals filled Jamie's tent with a ruddy heat. Sir Davin shrugged out of his cloak and tossed it at little Lou.
You a piper, boy, he growled. You have a runty luke to you.
I'm Lewis Piper, if it please my lord.
I beat your brother bloody in a melee once. That runty little fool took offence when he asked him if that was his sister dancing naked on his shield.
She's a sigil of our house. We don't have a sister.
More's a pity. Your sigil has nice teats. What sort of man hides behind a naked woman, though? Every time I thumped your brother's shield, I felt unchivalrous.
Enough, said Jamie, laughing. Leave him be. Pierre was mulling wine for them, stirring the kettle with a spoon.
I need to know what I can expect to find at Riveron.
His cousin shrugged.
Ah, the siege drags on. The blackfish sits inside the castle. We sit outside in our camps. Bloody boring, if you want the truth.
Sir Davin seated himself upon a camp stool.
Tully ought to make a sortie to remind us all we're still at war. Be nice if he called some phrase, too. Ryman, for a start. The man's more drunk off than not. Oh, and Edwin. Not as thick as his father, but full of it, as a boil's full of pus. And our own Sir Emmon. No, Lord Emmon. Seven Savers. Must not forget his new title. Our Lord of Riveron does nought but try to tell me how to run the siege. He wants me to take the castle without damaging it, since it is now his lordly seat.
Is that wine hot yet? Jamie asked Pierre.
Yes, my lord.
The girl covered her mouth when she spoke. Peck served the wine on a golden platter. Sir Davin pulled off his gloves and took a cup.
Thank you, boy. Who might you be?
Jasmine Peckleton, if it please my lord.
Peck was a hero on the Blackwater, Jamie said. He slew two knights and captured two more.
He must be more dangerous than he looked, lad. Is that a beard, or did you forget to wash the dirt off your face? Stannis Baratheon's wife has a thicker moustache. How old are you?
15, sir.
Sir Davin snorted. You know the best thing about heroes, Jamie? They all die young and leave more women for the rest of us. He tossed the cup back to the squire. Fill that full again, and I'll call you hero, too.
I've a thirst.
Jamie lifted his own cup left-handed and took a swallow. The warmth spread through his chest. You were speaking of the phrase you wanted dead, Ryman, Edwin, Emmon.
And Walder Rivers, Davin said. That whoreson. Hates that he's a bastard, and hates everyone who's not. Sir Perwin seems a decent fellow, though. Might as well spare him.
The women, too, I'm to marry one, I hear.
Your father might have seen fit to consult with me about this marriage, by the by.
My own father was treating with Paxter Redwin before Oxcross. Did you know? Redwin has a nicely dowered daughter.
Dismira.
Jamie laughed.
How well do you like Freckles? If my choice is Freys or Freckles, well, half of Lord Walder's brood look like stoats.
Only half. Be thankful. I saw Lancel's bride at Derry.
Gatehouse Amy. Gods be good. I couldn't believe that Lancel picked that one. What's wrong with that boy?
He's grown pious, said Jamie. But it wasn't him who did the picking. Lady Amorai's mother is at Derry. Her uncle thought she'd help Lancel win the Derry small folk.
Oh, by fucking them? You know why they call her Gatehouse Amy? She raises her portcullis for every knight who happens by. Lancel had best find an armourer to make him a horned helm.
That won't be necessary.
Our Khazars off to King's Landing to take vows as one of the High Septon Swords. Sir Devon could not have looked more astonished if Jamie had told him that Lancel had decided to become a mummer's monkey.
Not truly, you're japing with me. Gatehouse Amy must be more stoutish than I'd heard. If she could drive the boy to that...
When Jamie had taken his leave of Lady Amory, she had been weeping softly at the dissolution of her marriage whilst letting Lyle Crakehall console her. Her tears had not troubled him half so much as the hard looks on the faces of her kin as they stood about the yard. "I hope you do not intend to take vows as well, Coz," he said to Devon. "The Freys are prickly where marriage contracts are concerned. I would hate to disappoint them again." Sir Devon snorted.
"Ha! I'll wed and bed my stoat, never fear. I know what happened to Rob Stark. From what Edwin tells me, though, I'd best pick one who hasn't flowered yet, or I'm like to find that Black Walder has been there first. I'll wager he's had Gatehouse Amy and more than thrice. Maybe that explains Lancel's godliness and his father's mood."
"You have seen Sir Kevin?"
"Aye. He passed here on his way west. I asked him to help us take the castle, but Kevin would have none of it. He brooded the whole time he was here. Courteous enough, but chilly. I swore to him that I never asked to be made Warden of the West, that the honour should have gone to him, and he declared that he held no grudge against me. But you would never have known it from his tone. He stayed 3 days, and hardly said 3 words to me.
Would that he'd remained. I could have used his counsel. Our friends of Frey would not have dared vex Sir Kevin the way they've been vexing me." "Tell me," said Jamie.
"I would, but where to begin? Whilst I've been building rams and siege towers, Ryman Frey has raised a gibbet. Every day at dawn he brings forth Edmure Tully, drapes a noose around his neck, and threatens to hang him unless the castle yields. The blackfish pays his mummer's show no mind. So, come evenfall, Lord Edmure is taken down again. His wife's with child, did you know?"
"He hadn't."
"Edmure bedded her after the Red Wedding?" "He was bedding her during the Red Wedding. Rosalind's a pretty little thing, hardly stoutish at all, and fond of Edmure, queerly. Perrin tells me she's praying for a girl."
Jamie considered that a moment.
"Once Edmure's son is born, Lord Walder will have no more need of Edmure. That's how I see it, too. Our good uncle Lord Emmon, that is, he wants Edmure hanged at once. The presence of a Tully, Lord of Riverrun, distresses him almost as much as the prospective birth of yet another. Daily he beseeches me to make Sir Ryman dangle Tully. Never mind how. Meanwhile, I have Lord Gawain Westerling tugging at me other sleeve. The Blackfish has his lady wife inside the castle, along with 3 of his snot-nosed whelps. His lordship fears Tully will kill them if the Freys hang Edmure. One of them is the young wolf's little queen." Jamie had met Jane Westerling, he thought, though he could not recall what she looked like. She must be fair indeed to have been worth a kingdom.
"Sir Brynden won't kill children," he assured his cousin. "He's not as black a fish as that."
He was beginning to grasp why Riverrun had not yet fallen.
"Tell me of your dispositions, Coz."
"We have the castle well encircled. Sir Ryman and the Freys are north of the Tumblestone. South of Red Fork sits Lord Emmon, with Sir Fawley Prester and what remains of your old host, plus the river lords who came over to us after the Red Wedding. A sullen lot, I don't mind saying. Good for sulking in their tents, but not much more. Mine own camp is between the rivers, facing the moat and Riverrun's main gates. We've thrown a boom across the Red Fork, downstream of the castle. Manfred Yew and Reynard Rottiger have charge of its defence, so no one can escape by boat. I gave them nets as well, to fish. It helps keep us fed."
"Can we starve the castle out?" Sir Devon shook his head.
"The Blackfish expelled all the useless mouths from Riverrun and picked this country clean. He has enough stores to keep man and horse alive for 2 full years.
And how well are we provisioned? Well, so long as there are fish in the river, we won't starve,
though I don't know how we're going to feed the horses. The Freys are hauling food and fodder down from the twins, but Sir Ryman claims he does not have enough to share, so we must forage for ourselves. Half the men I sent off to look for food do not return. Some are deserting. Others we find ripening under trees with ropes about their necks.
We came on some the day before last, said Jamie. Adam Marbrandt's scouts had found them hanging black-faced beneath a crab-apple tree. The corpses had been stripped naked, and each man had a crab-apple shoved between his teeth. None bore any wounds. Plainly, they had yielded. Strongbore had grown furious at that, vowing bloody vengeance on the heads of any men who would truss up warriors to die like suckling pigs.
"It might have been outlaws," Sir Devon said, when Jamie told the tale. "Or not. There are still bands of Northmen about, and these lords of the Trident may have bent their knees, but methinks their hearts are still wolfish."
Jamie glanced at his two younger squires, who were hovering near the braziers pretending not to listen. Lewis Piper and Garrett Page were both the sons of river lords. He had grown fond of both of them, and would hate to have to give them to Sir Ilion. "The rope suggests Dondarrion to me."
"Your Lightning Lord, not the only man who knows how to tie a noose. Don't get me started on Lord Beric. He's here, he's there, he's everywhere. But when you send men after him, he melts away, like dew. The river lords are helping him, never doubt it. A bloody marcher lord, if you can believe it. One day you hear the man is dead, the next they're saying how he can't be killed."
Sir Devon put his wine cup down.
"My scouts report fires in the high places at night. Signal fires, they think, as if there were a ring of watchers all around us. And there are fires in the villages as well. Some new god."
"No, an old one.
Thoris is with Dondarrion, the fat Mirish priest who used to drink with Robert."
His golden hand was on the table. Jamie touched it and watched the gold glimmer in the sullen light of the braziers. "We'll deal with Dondarrion if we have to, but the Blackfish must come first. He has to know his cause is hopeless. Have you tried to treat with him?"
"Sir Ryman did. Rode up to the castle gates, half-drunk, and blustering, making threats. The Blackfish appeared on the ramparts long enough to say that he would not waste fair words on foul men. Then he put an arrow in the rump of Ryman's palfrey. The horse reared. Frey fell into the mud, and I laughed so hard I almost pissed myself. If it had been me inside the castle, I would have put that arrow through Ryman's lying throat."
"I'll wear a gorget when I treat with him," said Jamie, with a half-smile.
"I mean to offer him generous terms. If he could end this siege without bloodshed, then it could not be said that he had taken up arms against House Tully. You're welcome to try, my lord, but I doubt that words will win the day. We need to storm the castle."
There had been a time, not so long ago, when Jamie would doubtless have urged the same course. He knew he could not sit here for 2 years to starve the Blackfish out. "Whatever we do needs to be done quickly," he told Sir Devon. "My place is back at King's Landing with the king."
"Aye," his cousin said. "I don't doubt your sister needs you. Why did she send off Kevin?" "I thought she'd make him hand."
"He would not take it." He was not as blind as I was.
"Kevin should be a warden of the West, or you. It's not that I'm not grateful for the honour, mind you, but my uncle's twice my age, and has more experience of command. I hope he knows I never asked for this."
"He knows."
"How is Cersei? As beautiful as ever?"
"Radiant."
"Fickle."
"Golden."
"False as fool's gold.
Last night he dreamed he'd found her fucking moon boy. He'd killed the fool and smashed his sister's teeth to splinters with his golden hand, just as Gregor Clegane had done to poor Pierre. In his dreams, Jamie always had two hands. One was made of gold, but it worked just like the other. The sooner we're done with Riveron, the sooner I'll be back at Cersei's side." What Jamie would do then, he did not know. He talked with his cousin for another hour before the Warden of the West finally took his leave. When he was gone, Jamie donned his gold hand and brown cloak to walk amongst the tents. If truth be told, he liked this life. He felt more comfortable amongst soldiers in the field than he ever had at court. And his men seemed comfortable with him as well. At one cook fire, three crossbowmen offered him a share of a hare they'd caught. At another, a young knight asked his counsel on the best way to defend against a warhammer. Down beside the river, he watched two washerwomen jousting in the shallows, mounted on the shoulders of a pair of men-at-arms. The girls were half drunk and half naked, laughing and snapping rolled-up cloaks at one another as a dozen other men urged them on. Jamie bet a copper star on the blonde girl riding Rafe the Sweetling, and lost it when the two of them went down splashing amongst the reeds. Across the river, wolves were howling, and the wind was gusting through a stand of willows, making their branches writhe and whisper. Jamie found Sir Ilyen Payne alone outside his tent, honing his great sword with a whetstone. "Come," he said, and the silent knight rose, smiling thinly. "He enjoys this," he realized. "It pleases him to humiliate me nightly. It might please him even more to kill me." He liked to believe that he was getting better, but the improvement was slow and not without cost. Underneath his steel and wool and boiled leather, Jamie Lannister was a tapestry of cuts and scabs and bruises. A sentry challenged them as they led their horses from the camp. Jamie clapped the man's shoulder with his golden hand. "Stay vigilant. There are wolves about." They rode back along the Red Fork to the ruins of a burned village they had passed that afternoon. It was there they danced their midnight dance, amongst blackened stones and old coal cinders. For a while Jamie had the better of it. Perhaps his old skill was coming back, he allowed himself to think. Perhaps tonight it would be Payne who went to sleep bruised and bloody. It was as if Sir Ilyen heard his thoughts. He parried Jamie's last cut lazily, and launched a counterattack that drove Jamie back into the river, where his boot slipped out from under him in the mud. He ended on his knees, with a silent knight's sword at his throat and his own lost in the reeds. In the moonlight, the pockmarks on Payne's face were large as craters. He made that clacking sound that might have been a laugh, and drew his sword up Jamie's throat till the point came to rest between his lips. Only then did he step back and sheathe his steel. "I would have done better to challenge Rafe the Sweetling, with a whore upon my back," Jamie thought as he shook the mud off his gilded hand. Part of him wanted to tear the thing off and fling it in the river. It was good for nothing, and the left was not much better. Sir Ilyen had gone back to the horses, leaving him to find his own feet. "At least I still have two of those." The last day of their journey was cold and gusty. The wind rattled amongst the branches in the bare brown woods, and made the river reeds bow low along the Red Fork. Even mantled in the winter wool of the King's Guard, Jamie could feel the iron teeth of that wind as he rode beside his cousin Davin. It was late afternoon when they sighted Riveron, rising from the narrow point where the Tumblestone joined the Red Fork. The Tully Castle looked like a great stone ship, with its prow pointed downriver. Its sandstone walls were drenched in red-gold light, and seemed higher and thicker than Jamie had remembered. "This knot will not crack easily," he thought gloomily. If the Blackfish would not listen, he would have no choice but to break the vow he'd made to Catelyn Stark, the vow he'd sworn his king came first. The boom across the river and the three great camps of the besieging army were just as his cousin had described. Sir Ryman Frey's encampment north of the Tumblestone was the largest and the most disorderly. A great grey gallows loomed above the tents, as tall as any trebuchet. On it stood a solitary figure with a rope about his neck. Edmure Tully. Jamie felt a stab of pity. To keep him standing there day after day with that noose around his neck. Better have his head off and be done with it. Behind the gallows, tents and cookfires spread out in ragged disarray. The frayed lordlings and their knights had raised their pavilions comfortably upstream of the latrine trenches. Downstream were muddy hovels, wains and oxcarts. Sir Ryman don't want his boys getting bored, so he gives them oars and cockfights and boar-baiting, Sir Devon said. He's even got himself a bloody singer. Our aunt brought White Smile What from Lannisport, if you can believe it, so Ryman had to have a singer too. Couldn't we just dam the river and drown the lot of them, cuz? Jamie could see archers moving behind the merlons on the castle ramparts. Above them streamed the banners of House Tully, the silver trout defiant on its striped field of red and blue. But the highest tower flew a different flag, a long white standard emblazoned with the direwolf of Stark. The first time I saw a river run, I was a squire green as summer grass, Jamie told his cousin. Old Sumner Crakehall sent me to deliver a message, one he swore could not be entrusted to a raven. Lord Huster kept me for a fortnight, whilst mulling his reply, and set me beside his daughter, Lysa, at every meal.
A small wonder you took the white. I'd have done the same.
Oh, Lysa was not so fearsome as all that. She had been a pretty girl, in truth, dimpled and delicate, with long auburn hair. Timid, though, prone to tongue-tied silences and fits of giggles, with none of Cersei's fire. Her older sister had seemed more interesting, though Caitlin was promised to some northern boy, the heir of Winterfell. But at that age no girl interested Jamie half so much as Hoster's famous brother, who had won renown fighting the Ninepenny Kings upon the Stepstones. At table he had ignored poor Lysa, whilst pressing Brynden Tully for tales of Maelys the Monstrous and the Ebon Prince. Sir Brynden was younger then than I am now, Jamie reflected, and I was younger than Peck. The nearest ford across the Red Fork was upstream of the castle. To reach Sir Davin's camp, they had to ride through Emmon Frey's, past the pavilions of the river lords who had bent their knees and been accepted back into the king's peace. Jamie noted the banners of Leicester and Vance, of Root and Goodbrook, the acorns of House Smallford, and Lord Piper's Dancing Maiden. But the banners he did not see gave him pause. The silver eagle of Malister was nowhere in evidence, nor the red horse of Bracken, the willow of the Rigers, the twining snakes of Page. Though all had renewed their fealty to the Iron Throne, none had come to join the siege. The Brackens were fighting the Blackwoods, Jamie knew, which accounted for their absence. But as for the rest, our new friends are no friends at all. Their loyalty goes no deeper than their skins. Riveron had to be taken, and soon. The longer the siege dragged on, the more it would hearten other recalcitrants, like Titus Blackwood. At the ford, Sicanus of Case blew the horn of Herrick. That should bring the Blackfish to the battlements. Sir Hugo and Sir Dermot led Jamie's way across the river, splashing through the muddy red-brown waters with the white standard of the King's Guard and Tommen's Stag and Lion streaming in the wind. The rest of the column followed hard behind them. The Lannister camp rang to the sound of wooden hammers where a new siege tower was rising. Two other towers stood completed, half-covered with raw horsehide. Between them stood a rolling ram, a tree trunk with a fire-hardened point suspended on chains beneath a wooden roof. My cause has not been idle, it would seem.
My lord, Peck asked, where do you want your tent?
There, upon that rise. He pointed with his golden hand, though it was not well suited to that task. Baggage there, horse lines there. We'll use the latrines my cousin has so kindly dug for us. Sir Adam, inspect our perimeter with an eye for any weaknesses. Jamie did not anticipate an attack, but he had not anticipated the Whispering Wood either. "Shall I summon the Stoats for a war council?" Davin asked. "Not until I've spoken to the Blackfish. Jamie beckoned to beardless John Bentley. "Shake out a peace banner and bear a message to the castle. Inform Sir Brendan Tully that I would have words with him at first light on the morrow. I will come to the edge of the moat and meet him on his drawbridge." Peck looked alarmed. "My lord, the bowmen could—"
"They won't." Jamie dismounted. "Raise my tent and plant my standards, and we'll see who comes running and how quickly."
It did not require long. Pierre was fussing at the brazier, trying to light the coals. Peck went to help her. Of late, Jamie off went to sleep, to the sound of them fucking in a corner of the tent. As Garrett was undoing the clasps on Jamie's greaves, the tent flapped open.
"Here at last, are you?"
boomed his aunt. She filled the door with her fray husband peering out from behind her.
"Past time! Have you no hug for your old fat aunt?"
She held out her arms and left him no choice but to embrace her. Jenna Lannister had been a shapely woman in her youth, always threatening to overflow her bodice. Now the only shape she had was square. Her face was broad and smooth, her neck a thick pink pillar, her bosom enormous. She carried enough flesh to make two of her husband. Jamie hugged her dutifully and waited for her to pinch his ear. She had been pinching his ear for as long as he could remember, but today she forbore. Instead, she planted soft and sloppy kisses on his cheeks.
"I'm sorry for your loss."
"I had a new handmaid of gold," he showed her.
"Very nice. Will they make you a gold father, too?"
Lady Gemma's voice was sharp.
"Tywin was the loss I meant."
"A man such as Tywin Lannister comes but once in 1,000 years,
declared her husband. Emon Frey was a fretful man with nervous hands. He might have weighed 10 stone, but only wet and clad in mail. He was a weed in wool, with no chin to speak of, a flaw that the prominence of the apple in his throat made even more absurd. Half his hair had gone before he turned 30. Now he was 60, and only a few white wisps remained.
"Some queer tales have been reaching us of late,"
Lady Jenna said after Jamie dismissed Pierre and his squires.
"A woman hardly knows what to believe. Can it be true that Tyrion slew Tywin, or is that some calumny your sister put about?"
"It's true enough." The weight of his golden hand had grown irksome. He fumbled at the straps that secured it to his wrist.
"For a son to raise his hand against a father," Sir Aemon said, "monstrous. These are dark days in Westeros. I fear for us all with Lord Tywin gone."
"You feared for us all when he was here."
Jenna settled her ample rump upon a camp stool, which creaked alarmingly beneath her weight.
"Nephew, speak to us of our son Cleos and the manner of his death."
Jamie undid the last fastening and set his hand aside. "We were set upon by outlaws. Sir Cleos scattered them, but it cost his life." The lie came easy. He could see that it pleased them.
"The boy had courage. I always said so. It was in his blood."
A pinkish froth glistened on Sir Emmon's lips when he spoke, courtesy of the sour leaf he liked to chew.
"His bone should be interred beneath the rock, in the Hall of Heroes,"
Lady Jenna declared.
"Where was he laid to rest?"
"Nowhere. The bloody mummers stripped his corpse and left his flesh to feast the carrion crows. Beside a stream," he lied. "When this war is done, I will find a place and send him home." Bones were bones these days. Nothing was easier to come by.
"This war—"
Lord Emmon cleared his throat, the apple in his throat moving up and down.
"You have seen the siege machines, rams, trebuchets, towers. It will not serve, Jamie. Davin means to break my walls, smash in my gates. He talks of burning pitch, of setting the castle afire, my castle."
He reached up one sleeve, brought out a parchment, and thrust it at Jamie's face.
"I have the decree signed by the king, by Tommen. See, the royal seal, the stag and lion. I am the lawful lord of Riveron, and I will not have it reduced to a smoking ruin."
"Oh, put that fool thing away," his wife snapped. "So long as the blackfish sits inside Riveron, you can wipe your arse with that paper for all the good it does us."
Though she had been a Frey for 50 years, Lady Jenna remained very much a Lannister, quite a lot of Lannister.
"Jamie will deliver you the castle."
"To be sure," Lord Aemon said. "Sir Jamie, your lord's father's faith in me was well placed, you shall see. I mean to be firm but fair with my new vassals, Blackwood and Bracken, Jason Mallister, Vance and Piper. They shall learn that they have a just overlord in Aemon Frey. My father as well, yes, he is the lord of the crossing, but I am the lord of Riveron. A son has a duty to obey his father, true, but a bannerman must obey his overlord."
"Oh, gods be good. You are not his overlord, sir. Read your parchment. You were granted Riveron, with its lands and incomes, no more. Peter Baelish is the lord paramount of the Trident. Riveron will be subject to the rule of Harrenhal." That did not please Lord Aemon.
"Harrenhal is a ruin, haunted and accursed," he objected. "And Baelish, the man is a coin counter. No proper lord. His birth—"
"If you are unhappy with the arrangement, go to King's Landing, and take it up with my sweet sister. Cersei would devour Aemon Frey, and pick her teeth with his bones, he did not doubt. That is, if she is not too busy fucking Osmond Kettleblack." Lady Jenna gave a snort.
"There's no need to trouble her grace with such nonsense. Em, why don't you step outside and have a breath of air?"
A breath of air?
"Or a good long piss, if you prefer. My nephew and I have family matters to discuss."
Lord Aemon flushed.
"Yes, it is warm in here. I will wait outside, my lady, sir."
His lordship rolled up his parchment, sketched a bar toward Jamie, and tottered from the tent. It was hard not to feel contemptuous of Aemon Frey. He had arrived at Castle Rock in his 14th year to wed a lioness half his age. Tyrion used to say that Lord Tywin had given him a nervous belly for a wedding gift. Jenna has played her part as well. Jamie remembered many a feast where Aemon sat poking at his food sullenly, whilst his wife made ribal jests with whatever household knight had been seated to her left, their conversations punctuated by loud bursts of laughter. She gave Frey 4 sons, to be sure. At least, she says they are his. No one in Castle Rock had the courage to suggest otherwise, least of all Sir Aemon. No sooner was he gone than his lady wife rolled her eyes.
"My lord and master, what was your father thinking to name him Lord of Riveron?"
"I imagine he was thinking of your sons."
"I think of them as well. M will make a wretched lord. Ty may do better, if he has the sense to learn from me and not his father."
She looked about the tent.
"Do you have wine?"
Jamie found a flagon and poured for her, one-handed. "Why are you here, my lady? You should have remained at Castle Rock until the fighting's done."
"Once M heard he was a lord, he had to come at once to claim his seat."
Lady Jenna took a drink and wiped her mouth on her sleeve.
"Your father should have granted us Derry. Cleos married one of the ploughman's daughters, you will recall. His grieving widow is furious that her sons were not granted her lord father's lands. Gatehouse Amy is dowry only on her mother's side. My good daughter Jane is her aunt, a full sister to Lady Maria."
"A younger sister," Jamie reminded her, "and Ty will have Riveron, a greater prize than Derry."
"A poisoned prize. House Derry is extinguished in the male line. House Tully is not.
That muttonhead, Sir Ryman, put a noose round Edmure's neck, but will not hang him. And Roslyn Frey has a trout growing in her belly. My grandsons will never be secure in Riverrun so long as any Tully heir remains alive.
She was not wrong, Jamie knew. If Roslyn has a girl, she can wed Ty, provided old Lord Walder will consent.
Yes, I thought of that. A boy is just as likely, though, and his little cock would cloud the issue. And if Sir Brynden should survive the siege, he might be inclined to claim Riverrun in his own name, or in the name of young Robert Arryn.
Jamie remembered little Robert from King's Landing, still sucking on his mother's teats at four. Arryn won't live long enough to breed, and why should the Lord of the Eyrie need Riverrun?
Why does a man with a pot of gold need another? Ah, men are greedy. Tywin should have granted Riverrun to Kevin and Derry to Em. I would have killed him, sir, if he'd troubled to ask me. But when did your father ever consult with anyone but Kevin?
She sighed deeply.
I do not blame Kevin for wanting the safer seat for his own boy, mind you. I know him too well.
What Kevin wants and what Lancel wants appear to be two different things. He told her of Lancel's decision to renounce wife and lands and lordship to fight for the holy faith. If you still want Derry, write to Cersei and make your case. Lady Jenna waved her cup in dismissal.
No, that horse has left the yard. M has it in his pointed head that he will rule the Riverlands, and Lancel, I suppose we should have seen this coming from afar. A life protecting the High Septon is not so different from a life protecting the King, after all. Kevin will be wroth, I fear, as wroth as Tywin was when you got it into your head to take the White. At least Kevin still has Martin for an heir. He can marry him to Gatehouse Amy in Lancel's place. Oh, Seven, save us all, his aunt gave a sigh. And speaking of the Seven, why would Cersei permit the Faith to arm again?
Jamie shrugged.
I am certain she had reasons. Reasons? Lady Jenna made a rude noise. They had best be good reasons. The swords and stars troubled even the Targaryens. The Conqueror himself tread carefully with the Faith, so they would not oppose him. And when Aegon died and the lords rose up against his sons, both orders were in the thick of that rebellion. The more pious lords supported them, and many of the small folk. King Maegor finally had to put a bounty on them. He paid a dragon for the head of any unrepentant warrior's son, and a silver stag for the scalp of a poor fellow. If I recall my history, thousands were slain, but nigh as many still roam the realm, defiant, until the Iron Throne slew Maegor, and King Jaehaerys agreed to pardon all those who would set aside their swords.
I'd forgotten most of that, Jaime confessed.
You and your sister both.
She took another swallow of her wine.
Is it true that Tywin was smiling on his beer?
He was rotting on his beer. It made his mouth twist.
Oh! Was that all it was?
That seemed to sadden her.
Men say that Tywin never smiled, but he smiled when he wed your mother, and when Ares made him hand. When Tarbeck Hall came crashing down on Lady Ellen, that scheming bitch, Ted claimed he smiled then. And he smiled at your birth, Jamie. I saw that with mine own eyes. You and Cersei, pink and perfect, alike as two peas in a pod. Well, except between the legs. What lungs you had!
Hear us roar, Jamie grinned. Next you'll be telling me how much he liked to laugh.
No, Tywin mistrusted laughter. He heard too many people laughing at your grandsire.
She frowned.
I promise you this mama's farce of a siege would not have amused him. How do you mean to end it, now that you're here?
Treat with a blackfish.
That won't work.
I mean to offer him good terms.
Terms require trust.
the Freys murdered guests beneath their roof, and you, well, I mean no offence, my love, but you did kill a certain king you had sworn to protect.
And I'll kill the Blackfish, if he does not yield.
His tone was harsher than he'd intended, but he was in no mood for having Aerys Targaryen thrown in his face.
How? With your tongue?
Her voice was scornful.
I may be an old fat woman, but I do not have cheese between my ears, Jamie. Neither does the Blackfish. Empty threats won't daunt him.
What would you counsel? She gave a ponderous shrug.
Ha! Ems wants Edmure's head off. For once, he may be right. Sir Ryman has made us a laughingstock with that gibbet of his. You need to show Sir Brynden that your threats have teeth.
Killing Edmure might harden Sir Brynden's resolve.
Resolve is one thing Brynden Blackfish never lacked for.
Hoster Tully could have told you that. Lady Gemma finished her wine.
Well, I would never presume to tell you how to fight a war. I know my place, unlike your sister. Is it true that Cersei burned the Red Keep?
Only the Tower of the Hand. His aunt rolled her eyes.
She would have done better to leave the Tower and burn her hand. Harris Swift, if ever a man deserved his arms, it is Sir Harris. And Giles Rosby, 7 savers. I thought he died years ago. Merryweather, your father used to call his grandsire the Chuckler, I'll have you know. Tywin claimed the only thing Merryweather was good for was chuckling at the king's witticisms. His lordship chuckled himself right into exile, as I recall. Cersei has put some bastard on the council, too, and a kettle in the king's guard. She has the Faith arming and the Bravassi calling in loans all over Westeros, none of which would have happened if she'd had the simple sense to make your uncle the king's hand.
Sir Kevin refused the office.
So he said. He did not say why. There was much he did not say, would not say.
Lady Jenna made a face.
Kevin always did what was asked of him. It is not like him to turn away from any duty. Something is awry here. I can smell it.
He said that he was tired. He knows, Cersei had said as they stood above their father's corpse. He knows about us.
Tired?
His aunt pursed her lips.
I suppose he has the right to be. It has been hard for Kevin, living all his life in Tywin's shadow. It was hard for all my brothers. That shadow Tywin cast was long and black, and each of them had to struggle to find a little son. Tyjet tried to be his own man, but he could never match your father, and that just made him angrier as the years went by. Ah, Geryon made japes. Better to mock the game than to play and lose. But Kevin saw how things stood early on, so he made himself a place by your father's side.
And you? Jamie asked her.
It was not a game for girls. I was my father's precious princess, and Tywin's too, until I disappointed him. My brother never learned to like the taste of disappointment.
She pushed herself to her feet.
I've said what I came to say. I shan't take any more of your time. Do what Tywin would have done.
Did you love him? Jamie heard himself ask. His aunt looked at him strangely.
I was 7 when Walder Frey persuaded my lord father to give my hand to M. His 2nd son, not even his heir. Father was himself a 3rd-born son, and younger children crave the approval of their elders. Frey sensed that weakness in him, and father agreed for no better reason than to please him. My betrothal was announced at a feast with half the West in attendance. Ellen Tarbuck laughed, and the Red Lion went angry from the hall. The rest sat on their tongues. Only Tywin dared speak against the match. A boy of 10. Father turned as white as mare's milk, and Walder Frey was quivering. She smiled. How could I not love him after that?
That is not to say that I approved of all he did, or much enjoyed the company of the man that he became. But every little girl needs a big brother to protect her. Tywin was big even when he was little. She gave a sigh. Who will protect us now?
Jamie kissed her cheek. He left a son.
Aye, he did. That is what I fear the most, in truth.
That was a queer remark.
Why should you fear? Jamie, she said, tugging on his ear. Sweetling, I have known you since you were a babe at Joanna's breast. You smile like Geryon and fight like Tig, and there's some of Kevin in you, else you would not wear that cloak. But Tyrion is Tywin's son, not you. I said so once to your father's face, and he would not speak to me for half a year. Men are such thundering great fools, even the sort who come along once in a thousand years.
Cat of the Canals. She woke before the sun came up, in the little room beneath the eaves that she shared with Briscoe's daughters. Cat was always the first to awaken. It was warm and snug under the blankets with Talia and Bray. She could hear the soft sounds of their breath. When she stirred, sitting up and fumbling for her slippers, Bray murmured a sleepy complaint and rolled over. The chill off the grey stone walls gave Cat goose prickles. She dressed quickly in the darkness. As she was slipping her tunic over her head, Talia opened her eyes and called out, "Cat, be a sweet and bring more clothes for me." She was a gawky girl, all skin and bones and elbows, always complaining she was cold. Cat fetched her clothes for her, and Talia squirmed into them underneath the blankets. Together they pulled her big sister from the bed as Bray muttered sleepy threats. By the time the three of them climbed down the ladder from the room beneath the eaves, Briscoe and his sons were out in the boat on the little canal behind the house. Briscoe barked at the girls to hurry, as he did every morning. His sons helped Talia and Bray onto the boat. It was Cat's task to untie them from the pilings, toss the rope to Bray, and shove the boat away from the dock with a booted foot. Briscoe's sons leaned into their poles. Cat ran and leapt across the widening gap between dock and deck. After that, she had nothing to do but sit and yawn for a long while as Briscoe and his sons pushed them through the pre-dawn gloom, wending down a confusion of small canals. The day looked to be a rare one, crisp and clear and bright. Braavos only had three kinds of weather. Fog was bad, rain was worse, and freezing rain was worst. But every so often would come a morning where the dawn broke pink and blue and the air was sharp and salty. Those were the days that Cat loved best. When they reached the broad, straight waterway that was the Long Canal, they turned south for the fish market. Cat sat with her legs crossed, fighting a yawn and trying to recall the details of a dream.
I dreamed I was a wolf again.
She could remember the smells best of all, trees and earth, her pack brothers, the scents of horse and deer and man, each different from the others, and the sharp, acrid tang of fear, always the same. Some nights the wolf dreams were so vivid that she could hear her brothers howling even as she woke. And once Bray had claimed that she was growling in her sleep as she thrashed beneath the covers. She thought it was some stupid lie, till Talia said it too.
"I should not be dreaming wolf dreams," the girl told herself. "I am a cat now, not a wolf. I am Cat of the Canals."
The wolf dreams belonged to Arya of House Stark. Try as she might, though, she could not rid herself of Arya. It made no difference whether she slept beneath the temple or in the little room beneath the eaves with Briscoe's daughters. The wolf dreams still haunted her by night, and sometimes other dreams as well. The wolf dreams were the good ones. In the wolf dreams she was swift and strong, running down her prey with her pack at her heels. It was the other dream she hated, the one where she had 2 feet instead of 4. In that one she was always looking for her mother, stumbling through a wasted land of mud and blood and fire. It was always raining in that dream, and she could hear her mother screaming, but a monster with a dog's head would not let her go save her. In that dream,